the poison dart right between his eyes. The girl was pregnant. Pregnant with a Winbury bastard child. The thought is hideous, and yet it feels utterly predictable. Thomas Winbury the Elder, known to most as Tag, has taken the family down. His poor judgment, his base urges, and his weak character have desecrated the Winbury name. He has committed murder, and he will be caught. Greer can think ill of Tag all she likes, but in the end, she knows she will say and do whatever she needs to do to protect him. There's a knock on the bedroom door. It's Thomas. "The chief of police is back," Thomas says. "He'd like to talk to you next, Dad." Tag looks to Greer. She nods, but is afraid to say a word in front of Thomas. Tag should stick to the story they came up with. She tries to convey this with her eyes, but Tag hangs his head like a guilty man. Greer would like to go into the questioning with him. Let her talk. Let her present the argument. She, after all, is the storyteller. But that, of course, won't be possible. Tag got into this mess without her. He will have to go it alone. Greer is exhausted. It's nearly 4 o'clock, the hour the ceremony was to take place. She lies down on the bed. She is so tired she could sleep until morning. Maybe she will sleep until morning. Merritt Monaco. She was 29 years old. Pretty, but unoriginal. That was who Tag was screwing. Disgust courses through Greer's veins. She is hardly naive. She has written scenarios this nefarious and more so. There wasn't one original thing about it. A charming, rich, powerful older man with an indifferent wife seduced or was seduced by a young, beautiful, silly girl. It practically described the history of the entire world, from Henry VIII with Anne Boleyn to an American president with his impressionable intern. But it feels brand new, doesn't it? Because it is happening to Greer. Pregnant. When Tag is charged with murder, the papers will have a field day. Their wealth and the fact that Greer writes murder mysteries will make the story positively irresistible. The New York Post will cover it, then the British tabloids. Greer will be cast as an object of pity. Her fans will either cringe or rage on her behalf. The thought is horrifying. So many middle-aged women writing indignant Facebook posts or penning sympathetic letters. Thomas's and Benji's lives will be ruined. They'll become social outcasts. Thomas will be fired. Benji will be asked to resign from his charitable boards. Greer sits up. She can't sleep. She needs a pill. She goes into the master bathroom and eyes Tag's sink. His razor, his shaving brush, his tortoiseshell comb. She couldn't bear to walk into this bathroom and find Tag's side empty. They have been together too long. Endured too much. Greer opens her medicine cabinet, and as she does so, she gets a peculiar feeling of deja vu, as though she watched herself go through these exact motions a short time ago, and so a part of her knows that when she looks, her sleeping pills will be missing. Wait, she thinks. Wait just a minute. The pills were prescribed by her GP, Dr. Crow. Dr. Crow is doddering, nearly senile. He has been Greer's woman doctor since she moved to Manhattan. The pills are quite potent, as Crow likes to remind her, some cousin to the Quaaludes everyone was taking in the 70s. Quite potent isn't just some humble brag. The pills knock Greer out immediately and lock her in an obsidian casket for a full 8 hours. Greer doesn't keep her sleeping pills in a prescription bottle, but rather in a round enamel box decorated with a picture of a young Queen Elizabeth II. Greer received the box as a present from her grandmother on the occasion of her 11th birthday. The Queen Elizabeth box always sits in the same spot on the same shelf, and Greer knows why it's gone. Or at least she suspects she does. She closes the medicine cabinet and stares at herself in the mirror. She needs to think this through. But there's no time. She needs to talk to the chief immediately. She needs to save her husband, that bastard. Saturday, July 7th, 2018, 4 o'clock p.m. Nantucket. Marty Skazerba is sitting at the bar at the Crosswinds restaurant in the Nantucket airport, finally eating his lunch. He likes the Reuben, loves the coleslaw. He has gained 30 pounds since Nancy died, which isn't helping in his quest for a new girlfriend. A not unattractive woman in her early to mid-40s suddenly takes the seat next to his. She points at his sandwich and says, in a posh English accent, "I'm having what this chap's having, and a glass of Chardonnay, a large glass." Marty fumbles with his knife and fork in an attempt to flag down Don, the bartender, who is watching Wimbledon on the TV in the corner.
"Don, this young lady would like to place an order."
While Don takes the order for the Reuben, the coleslaw, and the large Chardonnay, Marty sneaks a better look at his new neighbor. She is blonde, or blondish, in halfway decent shape, with laugh lines around her mouth and fingernails painted cherry red. She is dressed in a strapless army green jumpsuit type of thing that Marty knows is meant to be stylish. It gives him a good view of her chest and arms. She's a bit puffy, but Marty is hardly sculpted himself.
"I'm Marty Skazerba," he says, holding out his hand.
"Featherly," she says.
"Featherly Dale."
She takes his hand and offers a smile. Then her Chardonnay arrives. She lifts the glass to Marty and says,
"I can't wait to get off this island. The past 24 hours have not been kind to me."
Marty wishes he had a glass to cheers her with, but he's still on the clock. He, too, has had one hell of a day, beginning and ending with the case of the murdered maid of honor and the runaway person of interest. It turned out the guy they were looking for was caught by a local teenage girl who works for the Highline. Marty is glad the guy isn't still at large, but he bristles at being bested by some kid who found him by using Facebook. That's cheating, is it not? Marty would have benefited from a little glory. He has been considering asking out Kira, the chief of police's assistant, but she's in her 30s and goes to bar class every day and is, likely, looking for more of a hero than Marty can currently claim to be.
"So, you're just visiting?" Marty says. "Where do you live?"
He knows better than to get his hopes up about anyone from off-island. He still has 2 years left until retirement, although after that, he'll be ready to go. Laura Ray and Ty will be happily married, maybe even starting a family, and Marty will become an annoyance. He hopes this Featherly says she lives in Boston. How perfect would that be? He gets 2 free round-trip tickets to Boston on Cape Air per month. He envisions himself and Featherly strolling around the public garden hand in hand, stopping in at the Parish Cafe on Boylston for lunch. They'll have cocktails down at the seaport. Boston is a great city for people in love. They can ride the swan boats, have high tea at the Four Seasons, go to a Sox game. And in 2 years, when Marty is ready to retire, his relationship with Featherly will be established enough to take it to the next level.
"London," she says. "I have a flat in Sloane Square, although I fear it'll belong to the bank by the time I get home."
London, Marty thinks as his dreams deflate. That's too far away. But it wouldn't be a bad place to visit Featherly for a casual, no-strings-attached fling. Marty has never been to London, which is something he needs to remedy, especially since his Match.com profile boasts that he loves to travel.
"And what do you do for a living?" Marty asks.
Featherly takes a long sip of her wine, then sets her elbow on the bar and rests her head in her hand to regard him.
"I sell antiques to rich people," she says. "What do you do, Marty?"
Marty straightens up a little.
"I'm head of security here at the airport."
"Well," she says, "that's a very prestigious job, isn't it?"
The way she pronounces the word prestigious in her English accent sounds so lovely. Marty grins.
He's the top gun, Dawn chimes in.
Marty silently thanks Dawn for the backup, even though he feels somewhat mortified that she's eavesdropping on his first attempt at a pickup since 1976. He bobs his head yes, then wonders if Featherly is making fun of him. After all, it's not like he's the head of security at Heathrow. That would be a hellish nightmare of a job, Marty thinks. Flights from all over the world converging. How would he ever keep track of the potential threats? And yet somehow those chaps do it, day in and day out.
In the summer, Nantucket is the second busiest airport in the state, Marty says. Only Logan is busier.
Logan? Featherly says.
The airport in Boston, he says.
Ah, right, Featherly says. Well, I'm flying standby to JFK on JetBlue. She checks her phone. I really hope I get on. She winks at Marty. You don't have any pull, do you?
With the airlines? Marty says. No.
This admission sends Featherly right into the electronic abyss of her phone. She sips her large glass of Chardonnay, then starts scrolling. Marty regards the second half of his Reuben, the cheese now cold and congealed, and his coleslaw, which has grown soupy. Before he loses Featherly entirely to the seductive allure of Instagram, he says,
So what was so bad about your stay?
Featherly sets down her phone, and Marty feels a childish triumph.
I couldn't begin to explain.
Try me. I came all the way from London for a wedding. Now, mind you, I had no interest in attending the wedding, but this man I've been seeing was going to be there, so I said yes.
Marty hears the phrase, man I've been seeing, and what's left of his enthusiasm flags.
Even someone not gorgeous but okay looking like Featherly has found someone.
Where are all the half-decent looking but not attached women? Marty wonders. Tell me.
And then, for reasons too awful to explain, the wedding was canceled.
Wait a minute, Marty says. Were you going to the wedding out in...
At that moment, Marty's phone starts ringing, and a discreet check of his screen shows that it's the chief of police. Marty has to take the call. He holds a finger up to Featherly.
Excuse me one moment, he says.
He relishes the opportunity to show Featherly that he really is sort of important.
What can I do for you, chief? He says. We're looking for someone else now, the chief says. And we have good reason to believe she's at the airport, trying to fly standby. Female, early 40s, blondish hair, name is Featherly Dale.
Marty's mouth falls open, and the phone nearly slips from his hand, but he manages to compose himself and offer Featherly a smile.
I'm on it, chief, he says.
Tag. He shakes hands with the chief of police and tries to strike the appropriate tone. Mournful yet strong, concerned yet guilt-free. When Greer woke up Tag, jostling his shoulder and saying, Celeste's friend Merritt, the friend, the maid of honor, Tag, she's dead. She drowned out front. She's dead. The paramedics are here and the police. Celeste found her floating. She's dead. Jesus, Tag, wake up! Do something! He'd thought he was ensnared in a bad dream. It had taken several long seconds for Tag to realize that Greer was real and that what she was saying was true. Merritt had drowned. She was dead.
Not possible, he thought.
He had dropped her off on the beach after the kayak ride. She had stormed off, upset, yes, but still very much alive. On solid ground. He'd thought she'd gone to bed. Tag isn't sure what the police know.
Do they know about the affair?
Do they know about the pregnancy?
They'll find out Merritt was pregnant as soon as they hear from the medical examiner. But will they learn about the affair?
Whom did Merritt tell?
Did she tell Celeste? Did Celeste tell the police?
Tag's first instinct upon hearing the hideous news was to find Celeste and remind her that the future of the Winbury family rested with her discretion. But Celeste had been taken to the emergency room to be treated for anxiety, and she hasn't returned to the house, which is, Tag suspects, a bad sign. Tag leads the chief to his study. Benji walked out after Tag admitted that it had been Merritt he'd taken on the kayak, and Thomas vamoosed as well. But both of his sons know better than to say a word to the police. Tag is confident of this. Their well-being is contingent on his well-being. Tag says to the chief, "Can I offer you a drink?" The chief lifts a hand. "No thanks." Tag settles in the chair behind his desk and offers the chief one of the two chairs facing the desk. This makes Tag feel in control of the situation, as if it were Tag who invited the chief in for a chat and not the other way around. Perception is reality, Tag thinks. Why not put the chief in the hot seat?
"What have you got?" Tag asks.
"Excuse me?" the chief says.
"A young woman is dead," Tag says, "and it happened on my property, or very nearly. Now, maybe it was an accident. Maybe Merritt had too much to drink and drowned. But if you have any evidence that something else is going on, then I deserve to know about it."
Tag hardens his gaze.
"Don't I?"
"No," the chief says, "you don't." Tag opens his mouth to say...
To say what?
It doesn't matter because the chief leans forward in his chair and says,
"When did you last see Ms. Monaco?"
Tag blinks. His instinct is to lie. Of course his instinct is to lie, because the truth is too incriminating.
"I saw her last night," Tag says.
The chief nods.
"At what time?"
"I couldn't say."
"All right," the chief says. "Where were you when you last saw her?"
"I was out back."
"Can you be more specific, please?" the chief says. "What were the circumstances surrounding the last time you saw Ms. Monaco?"
Tag takes a moment. He has had all day to consider various answers to this question, but now he's floundering. If he lies, they'll catch him, he thinks. And he is innocent. Where Merritt's death is concerned, he is innocent.
"We were out back under the tent, drinking," he says. "A group of us. Myself, my son Thomas, a friend of the family named Featherly Dale, and Ms. Monaco."
"And how would you describe Ms. Monaco's mood at that time?" the chief asks. Tag thinks about this. He had bidden Bruce Otis goodnight and had planned to go to bed, but Thomas had arrived back from town by himself. Abby had called and insisted Thomas come home. When he'd gone up to check on her, however, she'd been asleep.
"Or she was pretending to be asleep," Thomas said. "It's like she's trying to catch me at something."
"Catch you at something?" Tag said. He flashed back to the evening he ended things with Merritt, when he saw Thomas sitting alone at the bar at the Four Seasons. And so, instead of going to bed, Tag grabbed a bottle of good rum from the bar in his study. As his favorite auntie, Mary Margaret, used to say, "When you don't know what else to do, get drunk." Tag would have a heart-to-heart with Thomas. It was long overdue.
"Come on out to the tent with me," Tag said.
Thomas had needed no further enticement. He set up one of the round tables meant for the reception and brought over four folding chairs, thinking, Tag supposed, that the others might join them when they got back from town. Tag had just been pouring the shots when Merritt and Featherly appeared out of the shadows. It was almost as though they'd been lying in wait. Tag was spooked to see Merritt, but she'd offered him an apologetic smile, and Tag thought he'd seen acquiescence in her eyes. She would do as he asked. Take the money, end the pregnancy, walk away. He knew she didn't want a baby.
"Would you ladies care for a nightcap?" Tag asked.
"Answer to my prayers," Featherly said. Merritt hadn't spoken, although she did take a seat next to Tag, and when he set a shot in front of her, she didn't protest.
He had been a little uncomfortable about how chummy Merritt suddenly seemed to be with Featherly Dale. What were they doing together? And why was Featherly still at the house? She was staying at an inn downtown. She had waited until the last minute to book, and so she ended up in a real dump, as Greer described it. Maybe that was why she was hesitant to leave. Merritt seemed to be in fine spirits, Tag says to the chief. I mean, I guess. I really didn't know her well. Didn't you? The chief asks. Tag's gut twists. Now is the time to ask for an attorney. He had considered calling Sergio Ramon the second he found out Merritt was dead, but in his mind, hiring an attorney is as good as admitting you're guilty. And Tag didn't kill her. He didn't kill her. I had nothing to do with Ms. Monaco's death, he says. Not one thing. Were you having an affair with Merritt Monaco? The chief asks. I was, Tag says. But I ended things weeks ago. Did Ms. Monaco tell you she was pregnant with your baby? She said she was. Okay, then, the chief says. He leans forward in the chair. I'm going to guess that when you heard that news, you weren't too happy. I'm going to guess you would have gone to great lengths to keep that news quiet. Tag sinks into himself. Could he throw himself on the mercy of the chief? Maybe appeal to him man to man? One look at the chief tells Tag that the guy is honorable. He's wearing a gold wedding band. He has probably been married 25 or 30 years and never so much as glanced at another woman. I would have gone to great lengths to keep that news quiet, Tag admits, if I were even certain the baby was mine. Merritt was seeing other men. There's an Irish bloke named Robbie who bartends at the Breslin in New York City. It might have been Robbie's baby. But she told you it was yours, the chief says. Doesn't matter if it was Robbie's. She was threatening you. She was threatening to expose your affair. I'm sure that must have been scary for you, especially this weekend, when you were surrounded by family and friends. Your son's getting married. Seems pretty unfair for her to choose this time to air your dirty laundry. Tag hears the phony sympathy in the chief's voice, even as his words ring true. It was unfair. I told Merritt that after the wedding I would write her a check. I wanted her to terminate the pregnancy. He holds up his hands. That's bad, I know, but it's a far cry from killing her. The chief stares at him. Do you really think I'd be daft enough to drown a woman I was sleeping with, a woman who claimed to be pregnant with my child, and leave her to wash up in front of my house on the morning of my son's wedding? I wasn't that desperate. I was worried, definitely. But I wasn't desperate, and I didn't kill anyone. You did take Ms. Monaco out for a ride on your kayak, though, correct? The kayak we found on the beach? Your wife and your daughter-in-law both said you're the only person who uses the kayaks. Yes, Tag says. Yes, I did. Even though it was the middle of the night, the chief says. Did that not seem like a desperate measure to you? Reckless, at the very least? She said she needed to talk to me. Tag says, away from everyone, away from the house. And what happened while you were out on this kayak ride? I was paddling for an island beach out by Abrams Point, but it was dark, and I was having a difficult time finding it, Tag says. And when we were out in open water in the middle of nowhere, the kayak tilted to the right and I heard a splash. Merritt had jumped off. Tag leans forward. You have to understand. Merritt was unhinged. She was hormonal, emotional, mentally unstable. She admitted that the only reason she wanted to keep the baby was that it gave her leverage over me. Then she leaped off the boat like a crazy person. I had to paddle back around and haul her up by the wrist. By the wrist? The chief says. Yes, Tag says. And as soon as she was back up in the kayak, I paddled like hell for home. She got out on the beach and headed off. I thought she was going to bed. You didn't tie the kayak up, the chief says. You left it overturned on the beach, which I understand is out of character for you. It was unusual, Tag says. But I worried that if I hung around to tie up the kayak, she would reappear There would be more drama. She would raise her voice. People would hear us.
Tag drops his head into his hands.
I just wanted her to leave me alone.
Exactly, the chief says. You just wanted her to leave you alone.
He puts his hands on the desk and leans forward.
The medical examiner found a heavy-duty sedative in Ms. Monaco's system. So let me tell you what I think. I think you were pouring the girl shots and you slipped her a Mickey. Then you invited her out for a kayak and you accidentally on purpose capsized, and she never made it back to the boat. Or maybe you did as you say, and you pulled her up by the wrist. Maybe you let her pass out on the kayak and then you dumped her off closer to shore so that it looked like she went for a swim and drowned.
No, Tag says. That is not what happened. I didn't drug her, and I didn't dump her anywhere.
But you do admit you were the one pouring the shots, the chief says. Right?
Right, but
did she have anything else to drink? The chief asks.
Water, Tag says.
Water.
Featherly went to the kitchen at some point.
Now Tag can't recall if it was before or after Thomas went upstairs.
Before, he thinks. Thomas can vouch for him.
But no. No, it was after. Definitely after.
And Featherly brought out a glass of ice water.
Really? The chief says. He makes a note on his pad.
Yes, really, Tag says.
This suddenly seems like the detail that will save him. He had been wary when Merritt asked for the water because it seemed to indicate she was concerned about her health, or the health of the baby. And then Tag realized that he hadn't actually witnessed Merritt doing either of the shots he'd poured. He wondered if she'd thrown them over her shoulder. Featherly had been only too happy to fetch water for her new best friend, and while she was gone, Merritt told Tag she needed to talk to him alone.
Featherly brought Merritt a glass of water. Merritt drank the whole thing.
She drank the whole thing, the chief says. Nobody else had any?
Correct, Tag says.
He relaxes back into the chair. Maybe Featherly slipped Merritt a Mickey, or maybe they popped pills earlier in the night. Featherly is a wild card. Tag would have categorized her as harmless, but it's not beyond her to have accidentally wreaked this kind of havoc.
There wasn't a water glass on the scene, the chief says.
No? Tag says. This doesn't make sense.
Well, I'm telling you. Merritt drank a glass of ice water. Featherly got it from the kitchen.
Tag glowers at the chief, which feels risky, but he is through being intimidated. He didn't drug Merritt, and he didn't kill her. I think you need to talk to Featherly Dale.
I think you need to stop telling me how to run my investigation, the chief says.
He barely raises his voice, but his tone is stern nonetheless. He's a local guy. He must resent men like Tag with their showcase homes and their shaky morals.
I have one more question.
Tag is seeing spots in his peripheral vision, the first sign of a tension headache.
What is it?
Miss Monaco had quite a nasty cut on her foot, the chief says, and there were traces of Miss Monaco's blood in the sand on the beach out front. Do you know anything about this?
Nothing, Tag says.
She didn't have a cut on her foot when she was under the tent. You can ask Featherly. Ask Thomas.
So, she must have cut it when she got back on land.
Which is proof I delivered her safely.
The chief says,
it's not proof of anything, but thank you for your answers.
He stands, and Tag stands as well, though his legs are weak and watery.
I think it's pretty obvious Merritt took some pills because she was upset, and then she wandered back into the water and drowned, Tag says.
You could simply conclude that her death was an accident.
It would be easier on everyone. Her family, her friends, my son, and Celeste.
I could conclude it was an accident, the chief says.
And you're right. It would probably be easier on everyone, including my police department. But it wouldn't necessarily be the truth. And in my job, Mr. Winbury, I seek the truth, which obviously isn't something you'd understand.
I resent that, Tag says.
Oh, well, the chief says. But then, to Tag's relief, he heads for the door.
I'll let you know if I need anything else.
So, we're finished? Tag asks.
For now, the chief says.
Sunday, June 10th, 2018. Celeste. Benji is away on his bachelor party weekend. Shooter arranged for complete debauchery. Thursday afternoon, they landed in Vegas, where they went to their penthouse suite at Aria and gambled until dawn. Friday brought a double bill of race car driving and gun club. Saturday, they drove to Palm Springs to golf and have a $1,000 a head steak dinner at Mr. Lyons. And today, Sunday, they are to fly home. Before he left, Benji tried to apologize in advance.
There will probably be strippers, he said. Or worse.
Hookers and blow, Celeste says, and she kisses him goodbye. Or performing lesbians. I really don't want to know any details. Just have fun.
Should I be happy that you're not protesting this trip? Benji asks. Or concerned?
Be happy, Celeste says.
Celeste spent Friday and Saturday night in Easton with her parents. Her mother was finished with treatment. There was nothing they could do now but be grateful for each new day. Karen was feeling pretty good, so the three of them took a walk around the neighborhood and then went for an early dinner at the diner. Celeste had brought her wedding dress at her father's behest. He said,
You might want to try it on for your mom.
But why? Celeste said. You guys are still coming, right? To Nantucket?
Just bring it, please, Bruce said.
And so, once her mother was settled at home on Saturday night, Celeste tried on the wedding gown. She put on her white silk shantung kitten heels and her pearl earrings. She didn't bother with hair or makeup, but that hardly seemed to matter. Karen beamed. Her eyes were shining. She clasped her hands to her heart.
Oh, honey, you're a vision.
Thank you,
Bruce had mouthed from across the room. Celeste had twirled and tried to smile. Now, Sunday morning, Celeste drives back to the city to meet Merritt for lunch at a place called Fish on Bleecker Street.
I want oysters, Merritt had said to Celeste over the phone, and I don't want to see anyone I know. I have to talk to you.
When Celeste gets to Fish, Merritt is already there with a Bloody Mary in front of her. She's breaking peanuts between her thumb and forefinger and throwing the shells on the floor. Fish has the atmosphere of a dive bar, but there are yards of crushed ice upon which rest piles and piles of oysters. The Yankees game is on TV. The bartender wears a t-shirt that says, Sex, Drugs, and Lobster Roll.
Hey, Celeste says, taking the stool next to Merritt.
She plants a kiss on Merritt's cheek and orders a Bloody Mary as well. She feels she deserves a little hedonism. She has been performing her daughterly duties while Benji has been on a 3-day bender.
Hey yourself, Merritt says. Have you heard from Benji?
No,
Celeste says. I asked him not to call me.
Her mood is suddenly buoyant, her tongue nimble. Her stutter all but disappears when she's alone with Merritt.
Seriously? Merritt says.
Seriously,
Celeste says.
I wanted him to enjoy himself and not worry about checking in with a future wife.
Relationship goals, Merritt says.
Celeste takes a sip of her Bloody Mary. The alcohol and spice go right to her head. She considers telling Merritt that the reason she asked Benji not to call was that she didn't want to hear any news about Shooter. What Shooter had planned, what Shooter was doing, what funny things Shooter said. Celeste is almost to the finish line. The wedding is 4 weeks away, but still she's afraid she'll get tripped up by her irrational heart. Every day she thinks about calling the wedding off. Celeste takes another sip of her bloody while Merritt peruses the oyster list on the blackboard. It would be such a relief to confess her feelings to Merritt. That's what best friends are for, right? Technically, Celeste is being a bad friend by not telling Merritt. And yet, Celeste fears naming her feelings. She's afraid if she says the words aloud, "I'm in love with Shooter," something very bad will happen. Merritt orders a dozen oysters. She's in a West Coast mood, she says, so 6 Kumamotos and 6 Fanny Bays. Celeste has agreed to taste one of each in an attempt to cultivate a taste for the little buggers. Genus, Cressostrea. Species, Gigas. Merritt takes an exaggerated breath and says, "Please don't judge me." "I would never," Celeste says. "What's going on?" Merritt holds out her hand. "I'm so nervous, I'm actually shaking." "Just tell me," Celeste says. She's used to Merritt's theatrics. They're one of the reasons Celeste loves her. "I've been seeing someone," Merritt says. "It started a few weeks ago, and I thought it was a casual fling, but then the guy called me up, and since then, it's gotten more serious." "Okay," Celeste says. She doesn't understand what the big deal is. "He's married," Merritt says. Celeste shakes her head. "I thought you learned your lesson with Travis Darling." "Travis was a predator," Merritt says. "This guy I really like. The problem is, promise you won't kill me?" "Kill you?" Celeste says. She can't figure out what Merritt is going to tell her. "It's your future father-in-law," Merritt says. Her head falls forward, but she turns to give Celeste a sidelong glance. "It's Tag." Celeste is very proud of herself. She doesn't scream. She doesn't hop off her stool, leave the bar, and get back on the subway uptown. Instead, she sucks down the rest of her Bloody Mary and signals the bartender for another. "It's Tag. Merritt and Tag." Celeste has been hanging out with Merritt for too long, she thinks, because she isn't shocked. She can all too easily picture Merritt and Tag together. "Did it start when he took you to the wine dinner?" "A little before that," Merritt says. "I noticed him checking me out the Friday night of your bachelorette weekend while we were out front waiting for the taxi. And so on Saturday morning, I did an exploratory mission to see if he was actually interested. And he was."
"Have you slept with him?"
Celeste asks. Tag is an attractive guy and very alpha, which is how Merritt likes her men. But Celeste can't imagine having sex with him. He's older than her father. "Are you really 28 years old?" Merritt asks. "Of course I slept with him." "Ugh," Celeste says. "I'm sorry, but..." "I figured it would be a one-night stand," Merritt says. "He asked for my number, but I never thought he'd use it. But then, a week and a half later, he called me at 2 o'clock in the morning." "Oh, jeez," Celeste says. Her mind starts traveling the predictable path. What is Tag thinking? He's such a creep, such a stereotypical male douchebag. Up until this very moment, Celeste had liked him. It's heartbreaking to discover he's preying on her friend, a woman the same age as his children. Does he do this all the time? He must. And what about Greer? Celeste would never have guessed she would ever have occasion to feel sorry for Greer Garrison, but she does now. She understands the biological impulse behind Tag's actions. He is still virile, still seeking to spread his seed and propagate the species. But come on. Come on, Celeste says. Merritt cringes at the outburst. "Sorry," Celeste says. She dives into the second Bloody Mary. "I'm sorry. I won't judge you. But please, Merritt, you have to end it. Tomorrow. Or better still, tonight. "I don't think I can," Merritt says. "I'm in it. He's got me. My birthday is next week, and I asked him to take me away. I think he's considering it." "You're a grown woman," Celeste says. She winces. Her stutter is back. Of course it's back. Celeste went from feeling relaxed
to feeling like she just stepped off the tilt-a-whirl at the carnival with a stomach full of fried dough. He hasn't got you. You can't exercise free will and walk away.
It's all I think about,
Merritt says. He's in my blood. It's like I'm infected.
The oysters arrive, and Merritt absent-mindedly douses half of them with hot sauce.
Do you have any idea what that feels like?
In my blood.
Infected.
Yes, she thinks. Shooter.
No, she says.
Against her better judgment, Celeste stays with Merritt at Fish all afternoon. Celeste has a Cobb salad, Merritt a tuna burger with extra wasabi. They order a bottle of Sancerre and then, because Celeste is very slowly processing the news and Merritt is experiencing some kind of high at finally sharing it, they order a second bottle.
Sancerre is a Sauvignon Blanc that comes from the Loire Valley, Merritt says. Tag taught me that our first night together.
Great, Celeste says.
She is patient as Merritt gradually reveals the particulars of her relationship with Tag. They meet at her apartment. They once went out for sandwiches. Tag paid, pulled her chair out, emptied her trash. Tag is refined, he's mature, he is smart and successful. She knows it's cliche, but she is a sucker for his British accent. She wants to eat it, take a bath in it. Tag is jealous of Robbie. He showed up outside Merritt's apartment building in the middle of the night because he was so jealous.
Does he ever talk about Greer?
Celeste asks. She pours herself another glass of wine. She is getting drunk. Their food has been cleared, and so Celeste attacks the bowl of peanuts.
Sometimes he mentions her, Merritt says, but we tend to stay away from the topic of family.
Wise, Celeste says. Merritt tells Celeste that, just a few days earlier, Tag asked Merritt to show up at a hotel bar where he was meeting clients for drinks. They had sex in the ladies' room. Then Merritt left.
It's like a scene from a movie, Celeste thinks.
Except it's real life, her real best friend, and her real future father-in-law. She should be horrified.
But in an uncharacteristic twist, she is almost relieved that Merritt is doing something even worse than she is. She's in love with Benji's best friend, but she has exercised willpower. Willpower, she now understands, is an endangered species. Other people conduct wildly inappropriate affairs.
I have to get home, Celeste says, checking her phone.
Benji lands in 20 minutes and he's coming over for dinner.
You can't tell Benji, Merritt says. Celeste gives her friend a look. She's not sure what kind of look, because her face feels like it's made of silly putty. The air in the bar is shimmering. Celeste is so drunk.
Obviously not, she says.
Merritt pays the bill, and Celeste, for once, doesn't protest or offer to pay half. Nor does she refuse when Merritt presses $30 in her hand and puts her into a cab headed uptown. It's bribe money, and Celeste deserves it. Somehow she makes it up the stairs and into her apartment. She can't imagine sobering up enough to have dinner with Benji, but if she cancels, he'll think she's upset about his weekend away. She cannot tell him about Merritt and his father. She can't let anything slip. She has to act as though everything is fine, normal, status quo. She sends Merritt a text.
End it, now.
Please. Then she falls asleep face down on her futon. She wakes up when she hears her apartment's buzzer. The light coming through her sole bedroom window has mellowed. It's late.
What time?
She checks her bedside clock. 7:15. That will be Benji. She hurries to the front door and buzzes him in. Then she rushes to the bathroom to brush her teeth and splash water on her face. She's still drunk, but not as drunk as she was, and not yet cotton-mouthed or hungover. She's even a little hungry. Maybe she and Benji can walk down to the Peruvian chicken place, she thinks.
It's Sunday night, so Benji will sleep at home and Celeste can be in bed by 10. She has 2 all-school field trips coming to the zoo tomorrow. It's the curse of June. Celeste is immersed in these mundane thoughts when she opens the door, so what she sees comes as a complete shock. It's not Benji. It's Shooter. "Wait," she says.
"Hey, sunshine," he says. "Can I come in?"
"Where's Benji?" she asks,
and an arrow of pure red panic shoots through her.
Did something happen?
"He took a cab straight home from JFK," Shooter says. "Didn't he call you?"
"I don't know," Celeste says.
She hasn't checked her phone since before getting in the taxi to come home. Shooter nods.
"Trust me. He called you and left a message saying he wanted to go home to bed. There wasn't much left of old Benji when we got off the plane."
"Okay," Celeste says. "So what are you doing here?"
"Can I come in, please?" Shooter asks.
Celeste checks behind Shooter. The stairwell is its usual gray, miserable self. She thinks to feel embarrassed about her apartment. Shooter lives in some corporate condo in Hell's Kitchen, but even that must put her place to shame. She isn't supposed to care what Shooter thinks.
"Fine," she says.
She's doing a good job at sounding nonchalant, even a bit irritated, but her insides are flapping around like the Bronx Zoo's hysterical macaw Kellyanne. Benji has been diminished by his bachelor adventure, and Shooter doesn't look so hot either. His hair is messy, and he's wearing a New York Giants t-shirt, a frayed pair of khaki shorts, and flip-flops. He looks younger to Celeste, nearly innocent. She steps aside to let him in, then she closes the door behind him.
"So, how was the bachelor party of the century?" she asks.
Instead of answering, Shooter kisses her, once, and it feels exactly the way Celeste dreamed it would, soft and delicious. She makes a cooing sound like a dove, and Shooter kisses her again. Their mouths open and his tongue seeks out hers. Her legs start to quiver. She can't believe she is still standing. Shooter takes her head in his hands. His touch is gentle, but the electricity, the heat, the desire between them is crazy. Celeste had no idea her body could respond to another person like this. She's on fire. Shooter's hands travel down Celeste's back to her ass. He pulls her against him. She wants him so badly she could weep. She hates that she was right. She had known if this ever happened, she would become delirious and lose control of her senses.
"Don't stop," she thinks. "Don't stop."
He pulls away.
"Celeste," he says. His voice is husky. "I'm in love with you."
"I'm in love with you too," she thinks.
But she can't say it, and suddenly her good sense kicks in the way it should have a few moments ago.
This is wrong. It's wrong.
She is engaged to Benji. She will not debase that. She will not cheat on him. She will not cheat on him. She will not be like Merritt or Tag. They may think that the intensity of their desire justifies their actions, but that is morally convenient. Celeste isn't religious, but she does have an immutable sense of right and wrong, and she also believes, though she would never say this, that if Merritt and Tag continue, something bad will happen. Something very bad. This will not be the case for Celeste. She can't falter like this or her mother will die. She's sure of it.
"You have to leave," Celeste says.
"Celeste," he says.
"Leave,"
she says. She opens the door. She feels faint.
"Shooter, please. Please."
He stares at her for a long moment with those hypnotic blue eyes. Celeste clings to the small piece of herself that knows this is the right action. The only possible action. Shooter doesn't press. He steps out, and Celeste shuts the door behind him. Saturday, July 7th, 2018, 5:15 p.m.
Nantucket. Nick has just heard from the chief. His interview with Featherly Dale is suddenly very important. Tag Winbury, the father, is still a person of interest, but the chief isn't convinced he did it.
He admitted he took the girl out in the kayak, the chief said. He said she jumped off on purpose, and he yanked her back up by the wrist, which is consistent with the ME's report. He admitted to pouring the shots, so a reasonable explanation is he slipped a Mickey into one of the shots. But forensics found nothing in the bottle or the shot glasses. He didn't know about the cut on her foot. He said she must have cut it after they got back to dry land. We need to check with Featherly about the cut. And Tag said Merritt drank a glass of water that Featherly Dale got from the kitchen.
Water? Nick said. There wasn't a water glass at the scene.
Exactly, the chief said. So maybe he's lying, or maybe...
Someone got rid of the water glass, Nick said. The mother, Greer Garrison, had been in the kitchen at some point, getting champagne. Nick still has a feeling she's hiding something.
If Greer knew about the affair, and the baby, the chief said.
Maybe she slipped a pill into the drinking water, Nick said, and then went back and cleared the glass. Ran it through the dishwasher on the power scrub cycle. But how would she know Merritt would then go for a swim?
Maybe the father and mother are in it together, the chief said.
Both of them? Nick said. The night before their son's big wedding? A wedding they're paying for?
Another thing, the chief said. Tag Winbury is a smart guy. If he'd used the kayak ride to drown our girl, he would have made damn sure he locked the kayak up when he got back, right? To cover his tracks?
Are we overthinking this? Nick asked. Was it just an accident?
Be thorough with Featherly, the chief said.
You know me, Nick said. I'm a bloodhound. Nick is waiting in the interview room when they bring Featherly Dale in. He hears her squawking a bit out in the hallway. She's going to miss her flight to JFK. She needs to get back to London. Lucklow swings open the door to the interview room and ushers Ms. Dale inside. Nick stands. He and Featherly Dale regard each other. She says,
"Well, you're a tasty morsel, aren't you?"
Lucklow smirks and Nick extends a hand.
"Ms. Dale, I'm Nick Diamantopoulos, a detective with the Massachusetts State Police. I just have a few questions, and as soon as we're through here, assuming we're satisfied with your answers, I'll have Officer Lucklow get you back to the airport and on your way."
"If I had known the detective would look like you," Featherly says, "then I would definitely have committed a crime."
"If you'll just have a seat," Nick says.
Featherly wheels in her roller bag and sets a handbag bursting with stuff. A paperback novel, a hairbrush, an open bag of pretzels which spill all over the floor, on top of the suitcase. Then she grabs a smaller clutch purse from within the bag and brings it with her to the table, where she proceeds to put on fire engine red lipstick. Nick waits for her to get settled and thinks, "This woman is too disorganized to kill anyone, even accidentally." But maybe he's wrong. Featherly Dale is in her mid-40s. She's a bit chunky. She has hair halfway between blonde and red. It looks like she changed her mind in the middle of a dye job. And she's wearing what looks like a jumpsuit issued by the Air Force in 1942, minus the sleeves.
"Can I get you anything to drink?" Nick asks.
"Not unless you have a decent Chardonnay," she says. "You interrupted my lunch."
Nick takes a seat.
"Let's get started, Ms. Dale."
"Feather," she says. "My friends call me Feather."
"Feather,"
Nick says, and he nearly smiles. There used to be a transvestite prostitute on Brock Avenue in New Bedford named Feather. He pauses to remind himself that this is serious business and he needs to be thorough.
"Let's start with how you know the Winburys."
Featherly, now Feather, waves a hand.
"Known them forever," she says.
"Meaning?"
"Meaning, let's see. Tag Winbury went to Oxford with my older brother, Hamish, may he rest in peace. So I've known Tag since I was a kid. I reconnected with the family at my brother's funeral, and after that our paths kept crossing.
I own a business finding antiques for people like Greer. People who have more money than God and don't mind plunking down 30,000 quid for a settee. I found her some salvaged windows from a church in Canterbury. Those went for 10,000 quid apiece, and I'm pretty sure she's still got them in storage.
So you have a business relationship with the Winburys then, Nick says.
And personal, Feather says. We're friends.
Well, yes, Nick says. You came over from London for the wedding.
How well do you know Benji and Celeste?
I know Benji a little bit, Feather says. Celeste, not at all. Just met her last night. Her and her friend.
Shame what happened.
What happened?
Nick says.
Feather's eyes widen.
Have you not heard?
The bride's friend, Merritt, drowned. The maid of honor. I thought that was why you had questions.
No, right, it is. I do, Nick says.
Her disarray is throwing him off his stride.
I meant, what happened last night? You were part of the group that sat out under the tent drinking rum, correct?
Mount Gay Black Barrel, Feather says. Out of Barbados. You know, I've been to the estate where it's made. I love the stuff.
Who exactly was sitting at the table with you? Nick asks.
Tag, Thomas, myself, and Merritt, Feather says.
Then she adds gravely, the deceased.
So you say you just met Merritt last night, Nick says. How did that come about?
It came about the way those things do at a party, Feather says.
I noticed her right away. She was pretty and stylish, and she had natural confidence.
I love confidence.
Feather beams at Nick.
You have natural confidence. I can see it.
It's a very attractive trait in a man.
So you noticed her from afar, Nick says. Were you properly introduced?
Not until later, Feather says. Much later, in fact. After the party was over.
Nick makes a note and nods. He senses Feather needs only the slightest encouragement to keep talking.
I was desperately seeking another drink. The young kids went into town. Bride, groom, best man, Thomas. But no one thought to invite old Feather, and I just wasn't ready to go back to my inn. I tried to wrangle a bottle of booze out of the catering hell, but that didn't work. So I went on a hunt.
A hunt, Nick says.
I was stealthy, Feather says, because I knew if Greer saw me, she would put me right into a taxi.
Oh, really?
Greer doesn't like me, doesn't approve of me. She's old money, landed gentry. Grew up on a manor called Swallowcroft, went to Wickham Abbey, all of that. And she suspects I'm after her hubby.
Ha! Feather hoots. He's way, way too old for me.
Nick needs a verbal leash for this woman so she doesn't go wandering off, although he makes a note. Greer suspected Feather and Tag? Back to how you met Merritt.
So I was sneaking around a bit, tiptoeing, dodging behind bushes. Hotter than it looks because of motion detector lighting. I figured if I could get to the pool house, I would find alcohol.
Feather taps a finger against her temple.
Clever bit of sleuthing on my part there.
Anyway, I stumbled across the maid of honor sitting in Greer's rose garden. She was crying.
Crying?
I asked if she was all right.
Yes, she said.
Then I asked if there was anything I could do.
No, she said. I was surprised because I'd pegged her for naturally confident, and then there she was, like a little girl on the playground whose friends had all forsaken her. So I asked if she wanted to join in my caper.
Caper, Nick says.
Hunting for booze in the pool house, Feather says.
And she said yes and came with me.
Then what? Nick says.
We opened the gate. We selected a couple of chaise longues. I slid the glass doors to the pool house open, and voila, full bar. I made a couple of Grey Goose and tonics and brought them out. Merritt said she didn't want hers. Her stomach was feeling funny. And that was just fine by me. I had them both.
Did Merritt stay with you? Nick asks.
Yes, she stayed. We talked. Turned out we had a lot in common.
Did you?
We were both involved with married men, Feather says. I mean, what are the chances of that?
Not so slim, Nick wants to say, but he needs to tread carefully here. Feather seems to be genuine, but he has been at this long enough to suspect it might be an act. Did Merritt say anything?